In his book, The Muqaddama, Ibn Khaldun states that dynasties have a natural lifespan like individuals. They grow up and pass into an age of stagnation and then into retrogression. The Ottoman Empire had grown from a small rural state in 1300s Anatolia to a force to be reckoned with, controlling land in Europe and Asia by 1453. By the mid-1500s, the empire had reached its zenith, and under the rule of Sultan Suleiman, was the most powerful empire in Europe, controlling areas on neighboring continents and having the reins on the Khilafah. However, with the progression of time, the Ottomans weakened and inevitably fell into a long-drawn downward spiral. As the Ottoman Empire slowly began to trail Europe in civilizational progress, it attempted to undergo a drastic makeover to address its challenges. However, many of these reforms only served to further weaken the empire. Reform occurred on European lines. It sidelined religious education, gave preference to science, abandoned Islamic dressing codes, and downplayed the role of ulama. Simultaneously, there was a decline in the quality of Ottoman leadership. Its economy was no longer bolstered with booty, and it began to slide into debt. It was in this climate, towards the latter half of the 19th century, that the scourge of nationalism was unleashed on Ottoman lands. The result would not only be the demise of the empire, but also the death knell of the Khilafah, an institution that had provided a semblance of unity for the Muslim world for centuries.
He says that he found two weapons that they used. The first weapon was materialism, to make people think that religion was superstition and a foolish thing to believe. And he said their tools for doing this became very powerful with a lot of the material sciences that they developed. But the second tool that they used was nationalism. So he said to destroy Turkey from within, they used materialism. But to destroy Turkey from without, they used nationalism. So that the places where the Turks were protecting, like Palestine, suddenly the people in Palestine saw the Turks as occupiers.
As early as 1805, the Wahhabi movement, in alliance with the Saudi family, had launched an assault on the Ottoman custodianship of Makkah and Medina that led to the sultans losing dominion over them for a period of almost four decades.
They started challenging the sultan in a very important aspect, which is that he's not Muslim enough. He's not serious enough about protecting and upholding the principles of the faith. This was a serious blow to the Ottoman sultan, who had as one of his most important and most prestigious titles the protector of the two holy sites.
As the decades progressed, this kind of Arab opposition was exploited by foreign powers to strike a fatal blow at the empire. Orientalists and missionaries settled in Muslim lands and spread toxic ideas amongst Ottoman citizens. At the same time, Ottoman subjects were being trained and educated in these foreign notions in Europe. One particularly noxious concept that was propagated was that since the Turks were not Arabs, nor had the required spiritual pedigree to lead the Muslim world, they were ineligible leaders.
So they set up many associations in Turkey and in the other parts of the Arab world, for example in Beirut, in Damascus, in Cairo. They set up various associations. And many of these associations were set up by kuffar. They were not set up by Muslims, they were set up by Christians, in fact, who had a hatred against Islam at that time. And they used to distribute leaflets. And some of their leaflets, they used the leaflets which they distributed in the Arab world, they used to accuse Turkey that Turkey has taken the Khilafah from the Arabs. Turkey has violated the Sharia. Turkey has abused the deen. And this was written by people who were kuffar. The ones who ran these associations were kuffar, they were not Muslims. But they were inciting the Muslims, the Arabs, that the Turks have taken the Khilafah. This Khilafah is for the Arabs. And they incited the Turks, that these Arabs are not Turkish. You Turkish people are more important than the Arabs. So they created this incitement. They incited nationalism amongst the Turks.
By the time World War I began in the summer of 1914, the Ottoman Empire was nothing but a shell of its former self. Its former lands in Europe were now gone, as the Greeks, Bulgarians, Serbs and Bosnians were all either independent or under European control. All that was left was the predominantly Turkish lands of Anatolia and the Arab lands south of it, including present-day Syria, Iraq, Palestine and Saudi Arabia. At first, the Ottoman Empire decided to remain neutral during the war. They were not nearly as strong as any of the other nations fighting the war and were wrecked by internal and external threats. The Ottoman Sultan was nothing more than a figurehead by this point, with the last powerful Sultan, Abdulhamid II, having been overthrown in 1908 and replaced with a military government led by the three Pashas. They were from the secular westernized group, the Young Turks. Financially, the Ottomans were in a serious bind, owing huge debts to the European powers that they were unable to pay. After trying to join the Allied side and being rejected, the Ottomans sided with the Central Powers, headed by Germany, in October of 1914. The British immediately began to conceive of plans to dissolve the Ottoman Empire and expand their Middle Eastern Empire. They already had control of Egypt since 1888 and India since 1857. The Ottoman Middle East lay right in the middle of these two important colonies, and the British were determined to exterminate it as part of the World War. One of the British strategies was to turn the Ottoman Empire's Arab subjects against the government. They found a ready and willing helper in the Hejaz, the western region of the Arabian Peninsula. Sharif Hussein bin Ali, the Emir of Mecca, entered into an agreement with the British government to revolt against the Ottomans. In return, the British promised to provide money and weapons to the rebels to help them fight the much more organized Ottoman army. Also, the British promised him that after the war, he would be given his own Arab kingdom that would cover the entire Arabian Peninsula, including Syria and Iraq. The letters in which the two sides negotiated and discussed revolt were known as the MacMahon-Hussein correspondence. As Sharif Hussein was communicating with the British High Commissioner in Egypt, Sir Henry MacMahon. In June of 1916, Sharif Hussein led his group of armed Bedouin warriors from the Hejaz in an armed campaign against the Ottomans. Within a few months, the Arab rebels managed to capture numerous cities in the Hejaz, including Jeddah and Mecca, with help from the British Army and Navy. The British provided support in the form of soldiers, weapons, money, advisors, including Lawrence of Arabia, and a flag. The Arab rebels managed to capture some major cities from the Ottomans as the British advanced into Palestine and Iraq, capturing cities such as Jerusalem and Baghdad. The Arabs aided them by capturing Amman and Aqaba. It was during this time that Ottoman Medina also came under a crippling siege from Arab rebels. Omar Fakhri Pasha was the then Ottoman governor of Medina. Such a tight siege was imposed, and the specter of starvation was so grave that some residents were forced to sell their homes for a sack of grain. Accounts mention some having no choice but to eat cats and dogs to survive. Hundreds of residents left Medina to Lebanon, Syria and Turkey in order to stay alive. It is said that the Ottoman soldiers themselves ended up eating grasshoppers to survive. Fakhri Pasha remained resolute in defending the city, even with the odds stacked so heavily against him. He took refuge in Masjid al-Nabawi and was eventually captured and handed over to the rebels. Whilst in their custody, Pasha reportedly said, "O Prophet of Allah, I came here to protect you. Now it is in your hands to protect me." Medina left Ottoman hands on the 5th of Rabiul Awal 1337, or the English year 1918. Despite the critical role they played in ensuring success for the Allies in the region, even at the expense of fellow Muslims, the British were swift in betraying the Arab rebels under Sharif Hussein.
The outcome was not what was agreed in the Hussein-MacMahon correspondence. The British and French instead divided the land according to the secret Sykes-Picot Agreement that they had negotiated between themselves in 1916. Hussein was given just the Hejaz region in the Arabian Peninsula, and that was taken from him in 1925 by Ibn Saud.
According to Sykes-Picot, the British and French agreed to divide up the Arab world between themselves. The British were to take control of what is now Iraq, Kuwait and Jordan. The French were given modern-day Syria, Lebanon and southern Turkey. The status of Palestine was to be determined later, with Zionist ambitions to be taken into account. The zones of control that the British and French were given allowed for some amount of Arab self-rule in some areas, albeit with European control over such Arab kingdoms. In other areas, the British and French were promised total control. In 1918, the war ended with the victory of the Allies and the complete destruction of the Ottoman Empire. Although the Ottomans existed in name till 1922, and the Khilafah existed in name until 1924, all the former Ottoman land was now under European control. The war was over, but the Middle East's future was still in dispute between three different sides. The Uthmanis had lost control of Makkah, Medina and Al-Quds, but the British indicated that they would be satisfied with nothing less than the complete destruction of the Khilafah.
The British, they went to Lausanne in Switzerland, and they said, we have four conditions. We are going to recognize the independence of Turkey, but there are four conditions. Number one, the complete abolition of the Khilafah, expulsion of the Khalifa, and seizure of his property. The first condition of the British. What's the first condition? Destroy the Khilafah. Not only that, expel the Khalif. Not only that, seize his property. That's just condition one. Condition number two, Turkey must promise to suppress any movement undertaken by the supporters of the Khilafah. Number three, Turkey must cut her link with Islam. Blatant. Turkey must cut her link with Islam. Number four, Turkey must have a secular constitution and cannot have a constitution derived from the rules of Islam.
Mustafa Kemal then stepped up to knock the final nails in the skeleton of the Ottoman Khilafah.
Mustafa Kemal was the one, he went to the assembly and he put forward a decree enjoining the abolition of the Khilafah, and he said this, and I quote, "We must at all costs safeguard the endangered republic and make her rise upon a solid scientific basis. The Khalifa and the legacies of the Ottoman family must go. The dilapidated religious courts and their laws must be replaced by modern courts and laws. And the cleric schools, the schools of the ulama, must concede their place to official secular schools. On the morning of the 28th of Rajab 1342, the third day of March 1924, it was announced that the Greater National Assembly of Turkey had approved the abolition of the Khilafah and the separation of the deen from the state. And on that very night, Mustafa Kemal, he sent an order to the governor of Istanbul, telling him that the Khalifa Abdul Majid should leave Turkey before Fajr on the next day. So the governor went with a garrison from the police to the palace of the Khalif in the middle of the night. The Khalifa was forced to climb into a cart that took him across the border. And 2 days later, brothers and sisters, Mustafa Kemal, he gathered all of the people of the Uthmani Khilafah, the ones who were in positions of ruling, and he deported them outside the country. And in this way, brothers and sisters, the Khilafah was destroyed.
The Muslim Ummah lay orphaned by the developments, and all Muslims inevitably were left poorer by the Khilafah's passing. Hajj was suspended during the war, and immediately after that went through more difficult times. The holy cities had lost their waqfs, which had been instituted by the Ottomans, and many corrupt officials arose who extorted undue funds from the Hujjaj. In the almost 100 years that have followed the Ottomans, Muslims have seen their fortunes nosedive through a system of nation-states, corrupt leaders, oppression, mass killing and disunity. The heartland of what was the Ottoman Khilafah is today a cauldron of bloodshed and turmoil. Much of the problems Muslims in the region face today can be traced back to the betrayals and schemings at the turn of the 20th century. And this should be a foundation all seeking a harmonious future need to acknowledge.
People forget that Arabs fought against the Turks. They allied with the British and fought against the Turks. And the British promised them all these things. And much of what we're suffering now is from the betrayal of Muslims of that time. So these are the effects, and nobody wants to deal with what really happened. They just want to blame everybody else. You know, it's all somebody else's fault. But unfortunately, we inherit the troubles of the past. We inherit them.
It is not sensible for us to languish on past failures and mistakes, but what we have to do is educate people, Muslim and non, to understand the mistakes of the past to help prevent the same mistakes in the future. In the final episode of the series, we visit modern-day Turkey and explore if this vibrant nation holds within it the keys for a new Muslim dawn.